Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to Matthew chapter 16, verse 28, where we dropped off last session. And remember that we're bringing in parallels from Mark chapter 9 and Luke chapter number 9. Now, we had just been looking at the great confession issued by Simon Peter somewhere in the vicinity of Caesarea Philippi when Jesus asked the question, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And that was fantastic. Now, Peter did get himself in trouble later because Jesus went on to explain that he would soon have to go to Jerusalem and be mistreated and then crucified, but he would rise again on the third day. And the only thing that Peter and the others apparently heard was the idea about dying. So Peter took him aside privately and rebuked him on that. Don't talk like that. May it never happen. And Jesus, understanding that these apostles need to get their heads wrapped around the reality of the upcoming situation, told Peter that he was being a hindrance, that he was acting like a Satan, like an adversary in this, and that in fact, all of them were going to need to take up their crosses daily and follow after him if they were going to be his disciples. That no one can deny Jesus in this world and expect to be confessed by him in the world that is to come. Then he gives them this prophecy that we closed on last time. This is Matthew 16, 28. "Truly I say to you, there are some standing here," so he's referencing the apostles, "who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Mark number 9, or chapter number 9, verse 1, has it this way. "He said to them, truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power." And then Luke chapter 9, verse 27, "But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God." Now, this can be confusing if you don't pay attention to the immediate context that follows. And that is, in each case, the next story is the transfiguration of Jesus when three of the guys that are standing here right this moment will see Jesus in his glory talking to Moses and Elijah about the impending atonement, which is going to bring about the kingdom with power. So I'm going to just telegraph my conclusion ahead of time here. Jesus is not talking about his second coming when he makes this remark. He is talking about the transfiguration, which it's a foreshadowing of what will happen with Jesus' death and resurrection, which will then lead to his second coming later being so powerful. We have a problem that has arisen in the church because they don't apply this to the transfiguration. For example, in the Gospel of John later, John will make note that there was a rumor flying around in the church at that time when he wrote the gospel, that he, John, the beloved apostle, was not going to die physically before Jesus returned. And John corrects that and says, no, Jesus made no such promise. that when he was talking to Peter on the occasion of John chapter 21, and he said, if I want this disciple to remain until I return, then that's none of your business. But he didn't say that was going to be the case. So Jesus clearly did not come back before all the apostles died. So this passage, or these passages, have to refer to something before their deaths. And the only thing that makes good sense is the transfiguration that follows in each case. And with that in mind, let's go ahead and look at the wording in the three Gospels. Matthew chapter 17, verse 1 follows up with, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John his brother and led them up on a high mountain by themselves. Mark chapter 9, verse 2. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And then Luke's gospel has a slightly different wording. Luke 9:28. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. Now, some people want to scream contradiction at this point. There is no contradiction. It says here that it was after 6 days, which seems to me to mean on the 7th day after. So after 6 days have been completed. When Luke uses the word about, he means exactly what we mean by that, approximately. So about or approximately 8 days later. Well, 7 days is approximately 8 days later, isn't it? It's about a week. Plus the fact that Jewish time scale is based on a sunset to sunset day model. So if you're doing something before the sun goes down, you're still doing it after the sun has finished going down, you're actually doing it on two different days together. So I'm guessing that somewhere on the 7th day after these words at Caesarea Philippi, or near Caesarea Philippi, Jesus and his disciples went up on a high mountain, and they definitely stayed overnight before coming back down. Now, what high mountain? Well, there is this tradition that's been around for a while that the mountain is Mount Tabor in Galilee. And I reject that out of hand. Contextually, time-wise, we know that Jesus was already about 30 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. And the closest high mountain to that area is snow-capped Mount Hermon, which the peak of Mount Hermon is only about 14 miles north of Caesarea Philippi. So it makes the most sense, contextually here, that Jesus just simply took his disciples on the remote roads, the remote paths north of Caesarea, up into the heights of Mount Hermon. It would be a perfect place for a quiet get-together with his apostles. I don't remember the exact height. It's something like 14,000 feet, something like that, I think. Or maybe it's 9,000 feet. Whatever it is, it does allow there to be snow cap even during some of the summer months. But it is it's quite rugged up at the top, but lots and lots of trees on the lower slopes. So Jesus takes them up here Luke tells us specifically to have another prayer time. Jesus often is praying. Now, he takes his three inner circle guys to a remote location. And then we are told about the transfiguration. Let me read to you from Luke's gospel first. Luke 9:29. As he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered. Not that his facial features changed, but rather he began to glow in his facial features. And his clothing became dazzling white. So here's Jesus praying to God up on Mount Hermon, and suddenly his body starts glowing, his face definitely starts glowing, and then his clothes also start glowing. Matthew account puts it this way, Matthew 17:2. He was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun. So that's how bright we're talking. And his clothes became white as light. Mark simply says, he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. They very often had professionals that took care of clothing to try to get certain types of clothing as white as possible. Peter, who is an eyewitness of this, passing the information on through Mark, says, it was the whitest clothing I've ever seen. It was glowing white. And then we are told what happens next. I'm in Mark 9:4. There appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking to Jesus. Elijah, the great prophet from the divided kingdom period, and Moses, the very first prophet of the Israeli nation. Moses is long dead by the time this event happens, and Elijah is long disappeared by the time this event happens. I'm going to give you a suggestion to you that what's happening here is some time warping. Let's read a little bit more. Matthew 17:3. And Matthew, of course, has to get this information second-handed because he wasn't there on the mountain. Behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. So two of the Gospels tell us specifically Moses and Elijah were talking with Jesus. Do we know about what? Yes, we do. Because in Luke's Gospel, chapter number 9, verse number 30, it says, behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, or his exit, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now think about the context that we've just been reading. Jesus, about a week earlier, had told his apostles, eventually we're going to go to Jerusalem, where I am going to be abused, then I am going to be killed, and then I will be resurrected on the third day. So this becomes the exit of Jesus at Jerusalem, his exit from life, from physical life. So this is what Moses and Elijah are talking to Jesus about, the atonement. And I believe, I can't prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt, but I leave it for your own consideration. I believe that when Moses was on Mount Sinai with God, he was there twice in 40-day increments in the wilderness. I believe that not only was he shown the tabernacle, not only was he shown the laws that Israel was going to live by, I believe he was also shown the Messiah. That he was time warped, if you will, into this very moment that happened 14, almost 1,500 years later. Is that a problem for God? Absolutely not. And then I believe that Elijah, who, interestingly enough, also spent some time alone at Mount Sinai with God, seeing God's glory, just like Moses did, I believe Elijah was also shown Jesus, that there was a time warp that allowed him to be connected from his time many hundreds of years before Christ to the time period of the Christ, and that this actually contributes to both of these men's prophetic ability, that they both made veiled comments about the coming of the Messiah, and even, in some circumstances, about his death and glory. So, we are told in Luke this is from verse 33, as the men were parting from him. And so what we discover is that Peter and James and John were up on the mountain with Jesus. Jesus was praying, and the three disciples had actually started nodding off, slumbering, because it had been, you know, a long time that they were up there. They were not able to watch and pray with him for all the time that he was doing. And at the tail end of this glowing episode, this talking between Moses and Elijah and Jesus episode, that's when they suddenly became aware that this was all happening. And Moses and Elijah are about to depart from the story when Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents or three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And then Luke gives us the commentary, not knowing what he said. In the Matthew account, it says, Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it's good that we're here. If you wish, I will make three tents or tabernacles here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Same thing in the Mark 9:5 passage. Peter said, "Rabbi, it's good that we're here. Let us make three tents or tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And then we have Mark's commentary, which is sourced from Peter. "For he did not know what to say, for they were terrified." Now, throw yourself into their sandals. You're up on the top of this remote mountain, all alone with Jesus, and suddenly you're waking up from nodding off, and you see two figures, glowing figures with the glowing Jesus, and you catch little snatches of a conversation that they're happening about departure, exit, Jerusalem, and then you are suddenly struck with the fact that this is Moses and Elijah. Now, we have to ask the question, how did Peter and the guys know it was Moses and Elijah? Did they have like a little name tag saying, "Hello, my name is Moses. Hello, my name is Elijah"? No, of course not. Either they were given supernatural understanding that they were Moses and Elijah, or Jesus called them by name and they overheard it, and that's how they knew. But regardless of that, imagine yourself being in that situation, waking up and realizing you are in the presence of something immense, something amazing. something that is related to last day stuff. Remember that the Jewish people of this time period, they didn't understand two comings of the Messiah. The first coming for salvation, the second coming to make all things new. They were convinced that there would be the arrival of the Messiah and then everything would wrap up. So they also believed that Elijah would be the introducer of the Messiah to the people of the world. This topic is actually going to be addressed on the way back down the mountain tomorrow. And here's Elijah. Well, we must be on the cusp then of the introduction of the Messiah to the world. And if Moses is here, the great prophet of Israel, the giver of the law, that is clear evidence that we are now arriving at the end of days. And the next big holiday that's coming is the Feast of Tabernacles. When you make little lean-to structures in which to dwell, to remind yourselves as Jewish people that we are in the Promised Land, we are people of the covenant, we are the people of God living in the Promised Land. And there were some people that believed that the kingdom of God, the eternal kingdom of God, was going to kick off with the trumpet on the first day of the seventh month, followed by the Feast of Tabernacles later in that same month. So the Feast of Tabernacles is only a matter of weeks away when the transfiguration takes place. So Peter, on behalf of the other two guys, offers to build some tabernacles right here on Mount Hermon so that everybody could kind of stick around a little longer. But he only blurts this out because he's not sure what else he should say. And then we are told in all three Gospels, as he was speaking, a cloud overshadowed them. And then a voice spoke out and said, and I'm going to read to you first from Matthew, then we'll go to Mark, then we'll go to Luke. Matthew 17:5. He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." Mark 9:7. A cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud. "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." And then the Luke account, verse 34 of Luke 9. As he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my Son, my chosen one, my beloved one. Listen to him." So God the Father jumps in to the story at this point, just like at the immersion of Jesus, and offers firsthand testimony, "This is my Son." And then gives the imperative command, "You listen to whatever he says," which ties into the book of Deuteronomy chapter 18, that whatever the prophet says goes. He will bring the words of life. He will bring the words of judgment. Now, Matthew tells us that when the disciples heard this voice, heard this command, they fell on their faces and they were terrified. And then Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Rise, have no fear." And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. So as soon as God the Father's voice speaks and the cloud overwhelms them, remember the cloud it's the Shekinah glory of God. It's the glory cloud of God that Moses was first talking about in the book of Exodus. The glory cloud of God that came into the tabernacle and chased the priests out momentarily. The glory cloud of God that came into the temple when Solomon built it and chased the priests out temporarily. The glory cloud of God that overwhelms them in such a way that they can't think of anything other than keeping their heads down. But then Jesus touches them and says, "You're okay. Don't be afraid." And they look up, and there's only one personage left. Not Moses, the great prophet of Israel. Not Elijah, the great forerunner of the Messiah. Only Jesus. And that is very instructive to us all. That we may find ourselves sometimes distracted by a lot of the other great persons in Bible history. We may have favorite Bible stories that we like to teach. But when it all comes down to the crisis moment, to the point of it all, we have to say Jesus is the one on whom we must keep our eyes. There is no other one, no other name given under heaven among men by which we must be saved. We need people to see Jesus. We also need them to see Jesus in us. Well, that'll wrap it up for us. The only thing that's left to say is that these guys kept silent, and they told no one about these things until much later, after Jesus had been crucified and resurrected from the dead. We're going to close here, and when we come back on Monday, we will pick up with the rest of the story about how Jesus follows up with some important teaching after the Transfiguration.